as well. It's a pleasure to interview you today, which is the July the 5th. And the first question, could you please tell the story of how you applied for the position of a crew chief? And there's this lovely story around when you did come in to see Dan Aldrich, you put your Olympic gold medals on the table.
Sam, the way I came to Irvine goes way back to 1951 when I was an oarsman at Stanford University, and we had a race down here on the North Lido Channel. And it was such beautiful water. We had always rowed up there in that dirty and windswept bay off San Francisco. And to see this gorgeous, calm, lovely, beautifully tended piece of water was inspirational. And I felt at that time, my God, there should be a crew located down here. And after I was in the service, which was from 1952 to 56, and then I went to work in Los Angeles in the investment business in 1960, a friend of mine, Keith Cordry, who was a graduate of Cal and had a Premier Printing Company, which did the printing work for the investment company I worked for, Dempsey Tegeler and Company. And I was doing writing for them. I was doing their market research. Keith told me that he had...
Excuse me, just how do you spell Dempsey Tegeler?
D-E-M-P-S-E-Y hyphen T-E-G-E-L-E-R. And Keith Cordry was C-O-R-D-R-E-Y. Keith's son is active with UCI in the fundraising and developmental work. So Keith knew about my interest in rowing, and being a Cal graduate when UCI was in the very formative stages, he got involved with it. He went to a reception for Dan Aldrich in 1962 or 63. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he offered to introduce me to Dan. And so I came down to meet Dan. Dan was very generous. He gave me half an hour, and I did not understand then, but I think I have a picture now that when you are the chancellor designate for a new university, you are the target of every idiot, vegetarian, visionary, you know, everybody who has an idea about what should happen at the campus. And Dan probably had to listen to 1,000 people tell him how to run his campus, but he had such wonderful patience. And so I was one of those who told him why he should have a crew. And there was no very great, I mean, we liked each other, but nothing much happened. But 2 or 3 weeks later, I was in San Francisco on a Friday after, you know, Friday for business, and flew home on what was that famous airline we had?
PSA.
Yeah, PSA. And sure enough, here was Dan Aldrich on the same airline. And we sat next to each other, and he couldn't get rid of me for an hour. He concluded the hour by saying, well, if you really feel that strongly about crew, why don't you give me a written proposal? And I didn't know at the time how much I'd been thinking about crew, because in the interim, since rowing in 1951 or 52, I had gone on and competed in the Olympics in 56, and then had coached a crew at Menlo College in 59 and 60. And
there was Rome.
Well, yeah, but I hadn't gone to Rome. I had coached a crew at Menlo Junior College up near Stanford, where I was teaching.
What'd you teach?
I taught freshman English.
Wife taught freshman OCC for 21 years.
Is that well? Anyway, when I came down here, I had kind of in my subconscious, I'd been thinking about crew. And so when Dan said, why don't you give me something in writing? I went home that afternoon, and I had the weekend before me, and I gave him about a 38-page proposal on Monday. I typed it up. I knew exactly what to do.
And having Detroit freshman English, you had it well phrased.
The ability to write it out so he could read it. Anyway, it was, and I someplace I have a copy of that document, but it covered everything from where the boathouse should be located, to how it should be built, to how it should be financed, to how many kids should come out, to the kind of coaching, to the salary structures, I mean, and the equipment. I had the whole thing in my mind, and there it was. So it was, he received that, and after he had a chance to look at it, he said, if you can put together a support group and raise some money, in other words, put your money where your mouth is, he said, whatever you do, the university will match. And so with that challenge in hand, we put together a group we called the Founders of Rowing at Irvine. And John Starr's John Starr's name came up earlier in our discussion. He was one of those people, as was Harry Baker, as was Frank Jameson, and Senator George Murphy and his son, Dennis. Dennis had been an oarsman for me up at Menlo. And we had a Bill Lund, L-U-N-D, was another person who was very helpful. And altogether, we raised about $25,000. John Lusk was one of our founders, and he gave not only cash, but also tremendous construction services.
On Shoemaker Island?
On Shoemaker Island, yeah. So we were really blessed. We had, a visionary group of people, and at that time, $50,000 bought a lot. It bought enough to get us into the crew business in a major way. There was a big debate about whether we should begin with hand-me-down equipment or whether we should start off with first-class equipment. And I said we had to start off with first-class equipment. Having gone to Stanford, which was a hand-me-down volunteer coach operation where we didn't have a rigger and equipment would break and we could never complete a workout without something going wrong, I believe that the time, young people's time, is too valuable to waste it in half-baked operations.
That's an excellent philosophy.
Don't you think so?
I agree. Yeah. Very good. Well, now, then I have second question is, how did you obtain the island, Shoemaker Island, for the crew? Because obviously, OCC had its share.
Mm-hmm.
Then you wanted to have a separate share.
Well, clearly, once we got Dan interested and got the theoretical approval to go ahead, we needed a place to row. I needed a place to have our boathouse. And I remember contacting the city and seeing that vast bureaucratic pyramid that I would have to scale with no assurance that they would be able to find anything for me. And one of the people on the Founders of Rowing at Irvine, George Griffith, who had Griffith Construction Company, suggested that
G-R-I-F-F-I-T-H?
Correct. He suggested that I contact Bill Boland, B-O-L-A-N-D, who had a company called Shoemaker Incorporated, located on Shoemaker Island. So I went out to Shoemaker Island, called ahead for an appointment, and went out and introduced myself to Bill Boland. And Bill was a very approachable individual who ran a commercial dredging operation off of Shoemaker Island. And when I walked into his office in a corrugated iron shed there, Bill was in short sleeve shirt and Levi's or something of the sort, and I was all in my little business uniform. And we started to talk. I noticed that he had a model of a Corsair, the World War II Marine Corps airplane. And after college, when I got out of college, the Korean War was going on, and I went through flight training and became a Marine pilot, and I too had flown the Corsair. So when I saw this common thread, and we got talking about our experiences as Marine aviators, it was just heaven sent. I mean, it was a marvelous bonding,
yeah.
And Bill had fought all through the Second World War, and I had never fired a shot in anger. The Korean War shut down just as I was getting commissioned. But nevertheless, we were both Marine pilots, mm-hmm. and had a lot of camaraderie out of that. And so he was of a mind to be welcoming. He was the kind of person who, if you present him with a project, he would say, like Dan Aldrich, well, how can we do it? Not how can we find ways not to do it? Mm-hmm. And so... Yeah. He said, how can we do it? And I said, well, what we'd need, Bill, is about an acre and a half or 2 acres down here. And he said, where would you think it might be? And so we walked around the island and found this wonderful location on the backside with an eastern facing. So that it faces the dunes. And there's just this little slip of water that comes up there. So there are no wakes. There's no storm water beating against it. The wind doesn't work over a long stretch of water and build waves to pound into your docking structure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As a proof of what a wonderful location it's been, the original dock that we put in 1965 is still there. Actually, the fall of 65, mm-hmm. That dock is still there. And there's not another dock on the Pacific coast that's in salt water that is still in one piece, and ours is. You know, we've repaired it, but it's still the original structure is there. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful location. It's bare bones. We have only the boathouse, which takes the boats. We don't have toilet facilities. We don't have showers. We don't have any amenities, but we have enough room for a rigger or maintenance man to work, and we have enough room for 12 shells.
Now, the maintenance man was mentioned in an article about you in the LA Times about a couple of months ago.
Yes.
He was retired, and so his wife said, hey, there's an unpaid job here. Now go.
Yeah, that's right.
kicked him out of the house.
That's right. Randy McFerran.
That's right. That's the name of the man.
MC, capital FERRAN.
That's right.
Randy sold a paint manufacturing business at age 45 and retired. So,
is he happy doing?
He's happy, and we now have found an assistant rigger on a volunteer basis to help him. So he's even happier. The assistant rigger's name is Dan Runner.
R-U-N-N-E-R.
Dan's daughter Beth was a coxswain at UCI in 1981-82. He was a Lockheed engineer. He just retired a year ago. So he's going to be our assistant rigger.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, tell me, you got your crew, you got your shells, you got your island, and so on. Now you you get your crew together, and I noticed, to my surprise, that you had women coxswains at the beginning. Am I right?
Yes, you're right. Our first... we had, men and women coxswains, and of course today... women coxswains are very common, but at that time we had the first women coxswain on the Pacific coast, and she was strenuously objected to by some of the other coaches. But people
on ground.
Oh well, people hate change, don't they? It was a good experience for all concerned. We had a marvelous turnout. We had wonderful, right from the beginning, we had great participation in the program.
I remember in orientation at the beginning of the university year, they would have an eight.
Yes.
They mounted on a little, whatever you call these things.
They're little trolleys,
come by. It's
still that we still do that. We still bring the eight up on campus, so they can see it.
And so you had now who's arranged the schedules, Duval? I mean, did you work with say Ray Thornton, or I guess Crawford was the beginning, but he sadly got cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Did you arrange the schedules?
You mean the racing schedules?
The racing schedules.
Yes.
As to who you would race and when and so on.
Yes.
In San Diego or here right here in Newport Harbor.
Yes, they have every fall late summer, early fall, they have a coaches conference over a weekend, and all the Pacific Coast rowing coaches get together and determine who wants to race who at what location and what dates. And of course, there's a kind of a historical framework, and we were able to adapt ourselves to that. Yeah. And this last year, Mike Sullivan, who was a coach here at UCI and an oarsman at UCI, and had left UCI when Larry Moore came in, and Mike took on the chore of going to represent UCI at the coaches' conference when a coach had not been named for UCI for this current year, and so he got our schedule set this year. So I inherited a schedule, and now I'll attend the meeting this fall and set up a schedule for next year.
And that's how it was done when you started out. You met. They all met together, all the crew coaches, and worked out the schedule.
That's it, yeah, and that's still the way it goes. Yeah. We were talking about the young woman who was a coxswain. Her name was Karen Shoemaker, and Karen was a those were the 60s, and she was a delightful flower child. She was an art major, and I remember she used to. She had an old Volkswagen, and she would decorate it with little flowers and peace symbols. And she was a wonderful coxswain, and she and the stroke oar Mike Kemp became best friends, as you might imagine. And so that was one of the charming things about coaching in that era.
Well, now tell me how the summarize the first years. Well, you've already done that. Now, how did the rest of your years unfold? Which year did you retire?
I coached for 4 years.
So 65 to 69?
66, 67, 68, 69. Right, those four racing
seasons. Oh, four racing seasons.
Four racing seasons, right. And the first year we raced freshmen only, because that's all we had.
I remember that.
But the second year we raced varsity. And JV and freshman. And then Bob Ernst, who was the captain of the crew in that second year, graduated and became my assistant coach. And Ernie was a very dedicated young man and a wonderful coach, a great natural leader. And I had conflicts between coaching and business. It was difficult to get down here and coach every afternoon, and I was in the middle of my career, and I could do it under one set of circumstances, which were for the company I was working for, but that came to an end, and I had another opportunity in business up in Los Angeles, and so I turned the program over to Bob Ernst at that time, and he did wonderfully well with it. You know how young coaches are. I mean, if you give a young coach a shot at a major program, and he's got what it takes, he will work 24 hours a day at it. And that's what Ernie did. So he made the UCI program very, very successful.
But wasn't he in business also?
No, mm-hmm. No. Ernie was a full-time coach.
Wow.
Yeah. And one of the things that I don't want to say insisted on, but that I was very strong about with Dan and the Department of Athletics was that we should have a paid varsity coach and a paid freshman coach and a paid rigger, because then the department controls who they bring in there. If it's on a volunteer basis, you don't know what you're going to get stuck with. And I say that as a volunteer coach right now, but I've been a paid crew coach wherever I've gone. And I think that philosophically it's better to be able to pay the coach. Even if you don't pay him much, you can control him. Whereas if it's a volunteer, sometimes you get people in there that maybe the only thing that qualifies them is the fact that they can do it as volunteers.
Well, that's a very good point. I'm glad you made it. Now let me just rest a bit. I'll just check it. Question Duval is, how did you establish this business Books on Tape?
Well, let's see. I was in the investment business, the brokerage business up in Los Angeles. That's what I did from 1960 on. That's how I earned my living. And in 1966, we moved down here so that I could be closer to the crew and coach. And my work at that time involved my getting out and around to offices all throughout Southern California, brokerage offices. And I never had what you would call a commute. I was always going to different places. Mm-hmm. In 1970, we were still living down here, and I got a job in Los Angeles where I went to the same place every day. That's what you call a commute.
Right.
And it was an hour and 15 minutes up and an hour and 15 minutes back. And I did that for a couple of years and thought I would go out of my mind, literally. And because I was in the research side of the business, I knew how to research business ideas that came to my mind. And so I researched the area of listening to something while I was driving other than music and news. I wrote to all the libraries I could think of, all the recording companies, all the publishers, and all the many educational institutions, and I asked them what they had to listen to while I was driving back and forth to work. And the answer was not much. There were some language courses, there was the Bible on tape, there were some public domain books. All of them were sold rather than being rented. And when you buy a cassette out there in the big world, it costs you about $8. So if you buy a 10 cassette book, for instance, Lord Chesterfield's letters to his son, it was $80. And I bought Lord Chesterfield's letters to his son, which I loved listening to for a week. But I couldn't then go and spend another $80 for another book. And the books were only in the public domain. There was nothing current, modern. And it occurred to me, what there should be out there is a service that, one, rents books, two, full-length readings, three, modern current literature, four, available through the mail. I mean, it just made so much sense.
Yeah.
And then one day the light went on. And instead of railing against the fact that there wasn't such a thing, I decided I'd provide
it. You'd do it.
Yeah. And
that's the spirit.
So armed with the idea, I went to New York and actually had a partner time. He went to New York. I was still in the full time in the investment business. And he went to New York and made contact with publishers, authors, and agents, and came back, and enough of them were accepting of the idea that we had the basis to go ahead. He then lost complete interest and never made any follow-up phone calls, never made any follow-up letters.
What a disappointment.
Yes, it was a disappointment. He'd gone in January of 1974, and a year and a half went by. I was then coaching crew at UCLA, and a year and a half went by, and in the summer of 1975, when the crew folds up for the summer break, I thought, well, if this idea is ever going to work, I'm going to make it work.
Make it work.
And so I got on the phone and I called a number of these people that my friend had met in New York, and I said, "Hi, you never met me, but you may remember my friend Jim McElvaney back in 1974.
That's
I mean, it was
McElvaney.
A really cold.
How do you spell McElvaney?
MC capital ELVANY. McElvaney and I remain best friends, and he's done very well in business. He's president of Johnson & Higgins of California. And then he sold me back his interest in books on tape because he had other things to do with his life. So that's how we got started. Then Sigrid, who was my wife at the time and remains my partner in Books on Tape, when I got the rights to the first four books, which were Happy Days by H.L. Mencken,
yes.
Zelda by Nancy Milford.
That's Zelda, the
wife of F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Wife of F. Fitzgerald.
Right. And The Paper Lion by George Plimpton,
mm-hmm,
and a book called Oil and Water, by another gentleman whose name escapes my mind. It was about the Torrey Canyon super tanker disaster. We got the rights to those books, and I said, Sigrid, get these things recorded. They're full-length readings, right? So she said, how am I going to do that? I said, go over to UCI. There's somebody in the drama department there who can read it. So that's how we got our first books recorded.
Did a friend of mine called Victor Rombello ever read anything? He has a very nice reading voice. He's English.
Victor read a number of books for us in the early days.
Yes, he's a very nice chap and has a nice reading voice.
Mm-hmm.
He reads the lesson.
Yes.
He's one of the lay readers. I'm a lay reader also.
Mm-hmm.
He's very good.
Well, he read some of the early books for us and was very helpful.
And that's how you got started.
That's how we got started. And and those four ideas, you know, the rental, the full-length reading, the modern current books, and through the mail are the backbone of the company. That's
how it got started. Sound criteria, really. Well, now, how do we manage to entice you back as coach of the crew? And I said, we're most grateful to have you.
Let's see. I came back once before in 1974-75. I was coaching at UCLA, and Ernie left quite unexpectedly to take the job at Washington. And so they were left without a full-time coach. And Dan and I think Ray Thornton was director of athletics at the time. They felt comfortable asking me to come back and take it for a year. So I did then. And I coached the freshman team. The varsity had their own cohesion going, and they had a recent graduate student who coached them. But I worked with the freshmen for a year and then went back up to UCLA as varsity coach, and I coached there. J.D. Morgan had invited me back, and I coached there until 1980.
So am I correct? I'm a UCLA man.
Mm-hmm.
Am I correct that they have de-emphasized crew at UCLA?
Well, yes, they've made it a club sport.
It's not a minor. It used to be a major sport. It wasn't a circle.
And they've taken the funding away, but you know, it's hard to kill a crew, and the crew, the UCLA crew, is second on the coast only to Washington, and in the past few years has beaten Washington regularly. They're how they've done it, I don't know, but it's just been inspirational. So they are, you know, they're sure doing better than they ever did when I coached them. I got to say that they've got a marvelous program. So I got out of coaching.
Based upon the material as to how successful a coach is.
Well,
I don't know. He had a lot of material.
I think good coaches develop their own material. I think he was a fine coach.
Well, I think that, of course, that's true. But I mean, if you don't have some people with real potential, you can't squeeze blood out of the tube.
Yeah, I tend to think, Sam, that in rowing, everybody starts from scratch.
Oh, you do?
That's what I think. I mean, I hear a lot of coaches say, oh, gosh, you know, I need to give scholarships and all that. I absolutely don't believe it. I think that's the glory of the sport. It's a walk-on sport. People come to it. They've never had any experience before. They all start off even. And you can teach them in that first year of rowing 90% of what they ever learned. Look at what David Grant's done at Orange Coast.
I was just going to say, David Grant has been coaching for over 20 years.
Right.
He's the president, so he said in the paper he's taking a year off from crew, but he's why they went to Henley this summer and won their first race. I don't know what happened after that.
Well, I mean, you know, he doesn't have anybody who's ever rowed before. David does beautifully. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's the wonderful thing about the sport. And I think it's great because when the young men who are out for the sport, when they get that vision of the sport, it draws performance out of it, draws them into their potential. It draws their potential out of them. And it's thrilling. That to me is what keeps me coaching, is to be able to take a group of young people who are exceptional only because of their dedication, and to give them, to paint for them the picture, the vision, the possibilities of the goal they can achieve, and then have them set out to accomplish that. I mean, I don't care whether they accomplish it or they fall a little short, as long as they have that vision and go for it, commit to it, is to me the thrilling part of coaching crew.
Well, I certainly learned something. Well, then you came back in 70, what was it, six?
74, 75 for 1 year.
One year. Yeah. Then you came back just
went
about.
Back to UCLA, and then.
Then you went.
Then I didn't coach for 10 years.
You did your books on tape, yeah. And then you come back to us a year ago?
Yes, this fall.
We were very lucky. And they had a good crew here. I know.
Yeah.
I said, the thing I miss most is teaching. I went on 4 years after I retired, 67. Mm-hmm. So when I was 75, I think I'll quit. But I didn't really want to. They had mm-hmm. no money. Mm-hmm. And not that I took much money for one course, but mm-hmm. I taught for 4 years. Now, I don't go around can't go around the campus and see people I know.
Mm-hmm.
And once in a while, I'll run into a fellow on the crew, or he'd come in to take my classes.
Mm-hmm.
I really miss it. But I do keep up with the coaches, talk mm-hmm. to them to find out who's doing what.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I couldn't believe it when they dropped cross country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on men's track. I see Dan Aldridge. Every meet, he'd be out there at the beginning. He'd be tape measuring the shot put
uh-huh.
and the discus. And his head would get redder and redder, sun beating down on him. Oh, my. Now, what's the future in the crew here? What's the future of UCI?
Well, one, you never can kill a crew. Once the sport gets started, it has it's a very tenacious sport, very hard to kill it.
Yeah.
And so I think that it will continue. And as long as you have boats and water and young guys, you'll always find somebody to coach. And that somebody, even though I would prefer to see him paid,
yeah.
and I would prefer to, I mean, I have my own ideas about how it should be structured. Nevertheless, there is a certain freedom to not having any financial control of the university. It puts you entirely on your own resources. Who was it? Blake. He said, damn braces, bless relaxes. And we are so braced up now for our duty. We are so charged up to make this thing work. We're so confident that we're going to be able to do it, that it's inspirational to go down there. We mentioned Randy McFerrin. I mean, we have a volunteer varsity coach, a volunteer freshman coach, Dan Emmerich, who's a full-time student here at UCI, married, two children, getting his math degree. We have not one, but two volunteer riggers. We have enough people who've given us $25,000 so that we can keep the program going. We're running a $100,000 program for $25,000.
Oh.
Isn't it wonderful? Well, you know,
I feel badly yeah. that they got him more money.
Well.
I really do. I feel I'm happy the crew is still going. I'm sad that baseball is gone. I'm sad mm-hmm. that the tracks are affected badly. Tell me one other question which isn't here, but I'm interested in your observation. What do you feel about the women's crew? When I was up at Seattle, I was on a trip up to Vancouver that mm-hmm. took my vacation in the spring. I went mm-hmm. up there. I never see such beautiful flowers all the way up. Mm-hmm. I teach in the spring, taught for all my 50 years, and I'm seeing these these beautiful flowers all the way up. But in Seattle, I'm reading the crew, and they got a new coach. They've got a coach who's good in the women's crew,
mm-hmm.
and they got finally got a good stroke apparently. And she's from Finland or some mm-hmm. bloody place. Because she's quite inspirational apparently. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the future of women's crew?
Well, you know there are not just good men athletes, they're great women athletes too. Mm-hmm. And so that it would make sense to me that women's crew has a great future, not only in the United States as a sport, but at UCI. And right now, the women's crew operates out of the Newport Aquatic Center, which we were talking about today.
That's right.
They have a volunteer coach, and the university is going to fund them and give them, I think, $8,000 to $10,000 next year, which I think is appropriate because while the university isn't giving the men's crew any money, the men's crew has its own facility. So it seems to me fair that the women's crew would be funded to where they, you know, got the rent paid over at the NAC. I hope sometime that there will be an extra boathouse built down there, which the women can use on Shellmaker Island. And apropos of that, you know, we're trying to swap 5 acres of university land up on the Back Bay for the 2 acres where the boathouse is located with the Department of Fish and Game, so that we will own that property. And we can then, once we own it, we can then undertake a capital project.
And you put showers in there.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, well, make it, but also build a women's facility there.
Thank you for joining me. Well, I don't think really I have anything more except to say this has been a great pleasure. I'm now going to show you some interesting books.
All right, good.